Monterey, California. At the, what hotel is it?
The Doubletree Hotel.
The Doubletree Hotel.
It's right next to the Monterey Convention Center.
And that's, you know, bring along your swimming suit and, you know, get ready to enjoy the sun and to make things hot for the FCC and the CAB. Is there more you'd like to tell us about what you've been picking up from around the country on this issue of, well, what's happened in the last month around free radio? Any particularly encouraging words or any unusually discouraging incidents or anything
else?
No,
I mean, I think it's just a matter, it's all part of building a movement. You know, there's always setbacks here and there, but the movement continues, and people have to understand that the only reason the FCC is making any sort of sympathetic noises at all toward any sort of possible maybe, we'll think about it, considerations of low-power service is the fact that we've basically created an ungovernable situation for them. And I, quite frankly, don't put any stock at all in these current rulemaking consideration possibilities that are before the FCC. Of course, the buzzards are circling. I mean, the commercial, you know, people who have commercial dollars in their eyes have seen the creation of some sort of low-power service that would have commercial overtones. I mean, some people are talking about, well, go out and, find out where all the high places are in your town and get option leases on them, blah, blah, blah. And it's just really disgusting to see this kind of the buzzards are circling. It's like, my opinion is the reason where we are right now is because hundreds of communities have decided to empower themselves their own voices, and the FCC does not have the enforcement resources to deal with all this. They don't have enforcement resources or resources of any sort to deal with clogging up the court system with case after case. And quite frankly, I think we should remember the old situationist slogan from France in the 60s was, be realistic, demand the impossible. And that's what we're going to do. We're going to demand the impossible, liberate airwaves. And the way we make that demand is by many hundreds, if not thousands, of stations going on the air all across this country. And you have to realize this is a war, and there are always casualties, and people are going to get busted. They are going to get, attempted to find. There's all, no one said it was going to be easy, and no one ever said that desegregating the South was easy in the 60s. I mean, people got, in the Freedom Rides, they got drug off buses and beaten and clubbed and tear gassed, and that's not going to, people are not going to be facing that level of violence in this, but they're going to have to realize there, will be, have to be certain prices paid, but if you'll stand together, I mean, if, for example, when stations become targeted, if those communities come out and stand literally arm to arm in front of those stations and say, well, if you're going to come for this transmitter, you're going to have to come for me first and drag me away, well, that's going to call a whole different tune to this matter. And if communities can organize themselves, at this, sort of a bit higher level of militancy and in nonviolent fashion say, well, my body stands between, you and that transmitter, and that transmitter may happen to be all of Earth first, encased in, 600 pounds of steel and concrete with lockdowns all over it. I mean, well, so be it. That's the kind of campaign that we can, that we know how to put together as a campaign we know how to win, because the FCC will never be able to erase the negative image of having to drag off dozens of people with federal marshals all to get to a simple transmitter. That's not going to play very well.
I hear you.
So we have to up the ante. We have to up the degree of resistance and up the degree of resolve of how we're going to deal with this. And quite frankly, the way we deal with it is putting bodies on the line. We deal with it with outing in public these corporate broadcast entities for the bastards they are, and enemies of free speech that they are. And, we've already won this in the court of public opinion. I mean, everyone that I talk to, everyone supports this. I don't think we've ever received a letter in our mailbox saying, oh, what you're doing is terrible, leave the poor FCC alone. It's a thing we can demand the impossible. That is, that we can win. in this, but we have to have the resolve to do it and not just flake away into the night with at least a little bit of, huffing and puffing from the government.
Mm-hmm. Well, that's what the government wants. They want to intimidate people and get them to essentially censor themselves. But I see that you're not letting yourself be censored.
Absolutely not.
Speaking out, and I certainly am not. And hopefully the hundreds of people who show up at Monterey on July 25th at 1 o'clock to challenge the California Association of Broadcasters down there will also be speaking out and be heard throughout the country, throughout the state. And, I tend to agree with you. It is a hard thing for the kind of resistance you're talking about, and I don't know how many people are prepared to do that, but sometimes it only takes a few.
Mm-hmm. Well, I mean, if they start looking at the process, it doesn't have to happen. It only has to happen half a dozen times, Robert.
Mm-hmm.
They come into communities, and there's 100 people out there, protecting that station that's under threat, and they have to start dragging people away. They're going to do this in every case, and if people just stand there, and when they realize they're going to come into every community and face the same damn thing over and over,
mm-hmm.
they're just going to drop it. It's a no-win situation for them.
Have you come to a community that's actually done that or expressed an intention of doing
what?
Sorry?
I'm sorry, what?
Have you come to a community that's actually done that or expressed?
Not yet, but I think it's going to happen soon somewhere.
Well, I know I've heard about areas in Mexico and Guatemala resisting. Of course, their form of resistance takes the form of clandestine movement from hilltop to hilltop. So.
Right. It's going to come to that. And, the thing is, you have to realize that if we make that kind of resistance, they're going to back down because it'll be a public relations nightmare and disaster for them if they try to go ahead. In other words, that if for them to succeed, they'll have to nuke the whole forest.
Mm-hmm.
That'll be a public relations disaster.
Have you had any much contact with people in other countries and the experience of microbroadcasting there?
A little bit. I'll be getting much more contact when I go to Europe next month.
Well, maybe you can get back to us and give us a report.
Will do.
Is there more you want to say to the folks out there?
No, I think I've said it. I think the point is we have to, obey none at all and resist it all possible.
True. Well, thank you, Stephen Denifer, Free Radio Berkeley stalwart, and victim currently of an FCC.
I'm not a victim.
I should say subject of an FCC injunction.
I refuse to be a victim of anything.
I'm glad to hear that. Fair enough. Thank you for calling, Stephen.
All right, thanks. You all take care. And unfortunately, I'll be in Colorado during Monterey, so I hope everyone has a great time in Monterey and kicks the California Broadcasters Association's butt.
Well, we will hope to get some audio tapes or maybe even some videotapes so you can see what you missed.
Righto.
Thanks, Stephen.
Have a good party.
All right.
All right, bye.
Bye-bye. And that was Stephen Denifer calling from, I presume, Berkeley. Stephen Denifer, of course, is the man, perhaps the only one, who's actually been enjoined by name from broadcasting from Free Radio Berkeley. Although there's been, I guess, enough concern that a number of people, that Free Radio Berkeley itself is at the moment off the air, as is San Francisco Liberation Radio. But he is inviting all of you out there to come to Monterey on July 25th at 1 o'clock to have a strong vocal presence before the meeting of the California Association of Broadcasters. That'll be on Saturday, July 25th at 1 o'clock. If you want more information about that or want to volunteer to run a carpool or need help in getting down there, give a call in the next day or so, as I was saying before, to 423-HUFF, 423-4833. And after that, I think that Free Radio Santa Cruz itself will have some help around that, and that's on the Free Radio voicemail at 427-4523. Our phone lines, however, are now open in case you want to talk about anything you've just heard, the interview with Luke Hyken
attorney who's defending Stephen Denifer, or Stephen Denifer, what he had to say about resistance. Our phone line here in the studio is 423-5361, and that phone line is open. Open for you to call in here on Bathrobes Pier's Broadsides. I'm your host, Robert Norris. I have in front of me a resolution passed by the City of Berkeley a week ago, actually 8 days ago, and it reads as follows. Whereas a federal injunction has silenced Free Radio Berkeley 104.1, an action that has serious implications for the artistic community of our city and all other communities, and whereas the City of Berkeley is committed to the furthering of artistic independence and the open exchange of public information so that we may freely hear our poets, actors, singers, entertainers, and commentators, now therefore be it resolved that the Berkeley City Council approves the request by the Outreach Committee and artists of Free Radio Berkeley for moral support in their quest for free speech and free radio access. Be it further resolved that the Council of the City of Berkeley does hereby declare its disappointment with the federal court's injunction of Free Radio Berkeley 104.1. Signed, Mayor Shirley Dean. And the actual report of the Free Radio Berkeley Outreach Committee is somewhat longer, and I actually contacted a free radio broadcaster in Berkeley who put together this, well, one of the two broadcasters who framed it, Hallie Hammer. She and Will Henning put this outreach resolution together and presented it to Free Radio Berkeley. Apparently, Shirley Dean is a regular or perhaps an occasional guest on Free Radio Berkeley, as are other city council members. We, of course, have had Santa Cruz here. We've had council member Mike Rotkin. We've had, even had him on when he was mayor. But that apparently doesn't cut too much weight with him because, in spite of his alleged concerns with free speech and rights for poor people, it doesn't take him far enough to even consider taking the kind of resolution of support for Free Radio Santa Cruz that Free Radio Berkeley was able to get unanimously passed by the Berkeley City Council. We can only hope that Councilmember Rotkin will take a second look at this and do what his more conservative colleagues in Berkeley have done. Again, the Outreach Committee's resolution reads as follows. To our esteemed Mayor Shirley Dean and members of the City Council, the federal injunction to close the still small voice of Free Radio Berkeley is an action that has catastrophic implications for the artistic community of our city. No longer will artists, singers, actors, even politicians be allowed to hone their craft free of economic restraints that oppose principles of artistic integrity and independence. We of the creative fraternity are appalled by this decision to allow economic self-interest to interfere with the creative process and still the flow of artistic freedom in our community. According to Judge Wilkin, we are no longer allowed a public voice. We see this as an attack on the culture of our community by a government which makes claims to protect our freedom of expression while making legal concessions to the contrary. We believe that the City of Berkeley is committed to the furthering of artistic independence and will not stand for this violation of our right to free expression unencumbered by political and economic self-interest. We wish to submit one question to the esteemed Council of Public Servants. Is the Berkeley community better off now that Free Radio Berkeley is off the airwaves? Did you hear about Martin Luther King Middle School or the educational program that needs support at the Black Repertory Theater on KGO, KFOG, or KFAT? We believe the mayor and city council share the same goal of our poets, our actors, our artists, our singers, and our writers and entertainers, and are committed to further the spirit of Berkeley as it expresses itself through the myriad art forms that we call community. We submit our work for your approval. Free Radio Berkeley, the mothership station of the right to artistic and political freedom through the vehicle of micropower and the power of the First Amendment of the Constitution of the United States. We ask for your support in this crucial hour. We do not want your money. We only desire your moral support through a city resolution to do from your heart what you know to be right for the future of generations of artists to come. We submit, but we will not surrender. The price is too high. In peace and solidarity, Hallie Hammer and Will Henning's Outreach Committee, Free Radio Berkeley, 104.1, the mothership station of the micropower movement. And, of course, the most significant thing about that was the unanimous adoption of that statement and of the statement you heard previously by the entire City Council of Berkeley. This is the City Council that split so dramatically and vitriolically around the issue of the sitting ban that continues to be split around the issue of, for example, harassing people who are nude performers, who have all kinds of significant differences, but on this one issue, free speech, basic rights of performers over the air, the right of the community to talk to itself, to be able to have the kind of dialogue it needs to progress for our society to move forward, they had the basic common sense to say definitely yes. The FCC, the National Association of Broadcasters, the California Association of Broadcasters, they're wrong in trying to do this kind of censorship, and free radio needs our help, our moral support. Let's hope that the Santa Cruz City Council can be brought around to take the same point of view. There's a petition currently being circulated through our community from Free Radio Santa Cruz. You can look for Free Radio's table downtown, or you can call the voicemail at 427-4523 if you want to sign the petition. It essentially is a petition of support for Free Radio Santa Cruz, and I invite you to sign it. I've got more on Free Radio Berkeley. If you're interested, you might want to pick up the July 1st edition of the Anderson Valley Advertiser. It's a weekly newspaper. You can get it at the Book Loft right near the Rio Theater at Soquel and Seabright. Or if you don't mind going into stores that would arrest me if I walked into them, you can also get it at the Java House or the Bookshop Santa Cruz that also sell the Anderson Valley Advertiser. And it may be carried at the Santa Cruz Public Library. I'm not entirely sure what they're up to there. That's something you might find interesting. There's a long column on the Free Radio Berkeley situation in the July 1st issue of the Anderson Valley Advertiser. And there's also a good letter from former KPFA commentator William Mandel, an 80-year-old expert on Russia that some of you old-timers who have been around for a while will remember hearing Mandel. He was silenced by, they tried to silence him, the House Un-American Activities Committee back in the 50s. They failed. Now Free Radio Berkeley is being cut off the air as another, he sees as another attack on his basic free speech rights. Of course, he's right, and he writes about that as well. But we have so much to do today that we don't really have time to talk more about free radio. There was a lot done at the last city council meeting, or perhaps the agenda pressed forward as usual, but I should say there was a lot of protest, a lot of verbal protest and public statement made. The budget came to the city council last Tuesday, and was passed. At least most of it. I wasn't there for all of it. I got tired around 10 and headed home. I think it continued hour after hour. But the interesting thing was that we were able to pull items out of the budget and use them as a forum for talking about issues that they related to, and to bring issues to not only to the city council's attention, they couldn't care less, but to the attention of the citizenry who watches city council meetings over community television. And that really is the significant point. I want to remind you, however, at the moment that you are listening to Free Radio, Free Radio on 96.3 FM. Thank you. This is your radio station, and it's Bathrobe Spears Broadsides. That's my twice-weekly program concerned with civil rights for the poor, community affairs, police department activity, and the future of free radio. And we're on every Thursday at 6, every Sunday at 11 in the morning, and we'll be on until 8. And our phone lines are open if you want to join us. The phone line here in the studio is 423-5361. That's available. A big controversy that has been kind of hitting the metro and actually made it as far as city council last night. Once I get my tapes in order, I'll be able to play you the appropriate sections. Concerns the issue of Michael Hernandez, Scott Kennedy, both council members, and their attack on Phil Baer. Actually, they forwarded a complaint about Baer supposedly organizing or being a party to a meeting of landlords concerned with organizing discriminatory activities against Latinos. And Baer has severely contested this charge. He wrote a response to this in last week's Metro, which unfortunately I don't have before me. And in response to that, City Council sycophant Don Lane, who has been mayor, has been on the City Council, and now runs the ice cream shop Double Rainbow downtown, for all of you who want to go in and give them a piece of your mind, has responded with an attack on beer in the current issue of the Metro. And it's something that, if you're interested, we can get into. It's for those of you who haven't been following it, it may be a little arcane. The realities of all this have to do with the fact that the city council is currently trying to rush through a redevelopment agenda around the beach flats, which we've talked about a bit on this show. It's millions and millions of dollars to essentially eliminate housing in the beach flats, develop a huge giveaway to Canfield, the seaside company. Well, perhaps what I should do is read you the speech that I made in part at the last city council meeting. This speech I was not able to give in full, so you're going to get the thrill, however, of hearing the whole speech, because I've got you now. You're a captive audience until you turn off the radio, of course. And it's, I think it's a good speech. It's called The Canfield City Council? And it reads as follows. With the city budget up for examination, we have millions for the police department, millions for Canfield and the Seaside Company, millions for redevelopment, millions for parking lots, and pennies for the neighborhoods, the poor, and the people generally. All smoothly rationalized by that non-stop master of piffle and patter, Shadow Mayor Mike Rotkin. This is the man who can't stop praising our homeless facilities, but hasn't been able to propose a low-income campground or a 24-hour bathroom in all his 20 years as a Surf City socialist. This, in a city where 500 to 1,500 homeless tonight will have to find an illegal place to sleep. It took a concerted effort even to return Ocean Street traffic to its former speed at the Barson Street stoplight. That happened in the city council on Tuesday after massive community protest against the new stoplight that had been put in and replaced the stop signs down at Ocean and Barson. And that was only a temporary fix. Canfield team player Michael Hernandez, who seems to take his signals from Rotkin and Kennedy, gave residents some temporary help, but only as long as it doesn't clash with the beach flats giveaway agenda. The stoplights on Lower Ocean will be covered up until community rage dissipates. Cover-up here is the operative word. Catherine Byers' proposals that the stoplights be dumped was itself dumped. Canfield is now officially the defendant in a lawsuit by Shaz the Widget Man, who was supposed to be on this show today, but unfortunately he was unable to make it. But more about that later. Who was assaulted and injured by Canfield's goonies last summer. The incident involved a bizarre and arrogant policy down on the boardwalk. Once you enter their territory, say their signs, if they ask you to leave, you must leave behind your skateboard, rollerblades, or bicycle, or you will be barred from the boardwalk for a year. When Shaz questioned this policy, he was thrown to the ground, assaulted, and dragged off to jail. Luckily for him, in front of outraged middle-class witnesses who wondered just what was going on. Police Chief Steve Belcher sat on this assault report for 5 months, with the names and accounts of Shaz's witnesses now somehow missing from the report. The district attorney's office, ever friendly with the police department higher-ups and boardwalk security, has done nothing, even after a dozen calls, to rein in Canfield's Cro-Magnons. Shaz tells me that the Canfield security boss himself is, surprise, a former SCPD officer, which makes the whole arrangement quite cozy. Were Michael Rotkin and Scott Kennedy witnesses in court against homeless people last year? Well, when this issue was raised by David Silva at the afternoon edition of the city council, he was called a liar by those individuals, and particularly by Rotkin. However, I saw them. I saw Michael Rotkin and Scott Kennedy and Michael Hernandez sitting in the front row of Department 1, wasting city time and money with their self-justifying no sleeping in Santa Cruz antics. Perhaps Kennedy and Rotkin don't remember. Perhaps they were embarrassed. But they were there. This afternoon, Mayor Scott, this was actually two afternoons ago, she asked community members to call her if they witnessed or experienced police violence. Mayor Scott has not returned a call of mine in many a moon, but I guess she does call some people back. I find it a disgrace that our local union buster at her very own Planned Parenthood, Cynthia Matthews, has gone out of her way to rationalize police violence against Brian and Lori Andrus, Brian Anders, of course, is the man who was shot 5 times at Button Street by 4 police officers for allegedly wielding a baseball bat. Even before the Citizens Police Review Board gives its inevitable stamp of approval, Councilmember Matthews has reportedly pressured the City Commission for Violence Against Women to distort the domestic violence protocols in public letters to newspapers to cover for the hasty cops who shot up the Button Street neighborhood on a phony domestic violence call. In other words, they're saying because it was a domestic violence call, they had no choice but to break into this woman's house, assault her, and then shoot down her husband. Interesting logic. Nor have city staff clarified whether Brian Andrus actually received any medical attention at all from the 4 cops who shot 5 times and then left him face down in the mud. Celia Scott did seek to get a report and got a report from the city staff on whether he received medical attention from medics and paramedics who arrived later. The question that I had, however, which was not answered, was whether the police officers who shot this man down gave him any attention whatsoever as he awaited during that critical period when he could have died. And indeed, he went into a critical state in the hospital, and it was lucky that he lived. As an aside, it should be mentioned, Brian Andrus's jury trial will start in early August, and the Police Review Board now expects to postpone any consideration of the validity of the complaints against the police officers involved in this shooting for a long period of time. No surprises there. In the midst of this swamp, Celia Scott tells us she is not running for re-election. Who then is going to provide Catherine Byers with the backbone and the backup to speak truth to the Rotkin-Matthews redevelopment majority? While Celia has refused to deal with abuses in the Citizens Committee for the Homeless, Homeless Community Resource Center, Community House, Trailers Not Trolls, $2 million boondoggle, and must be condemned for that, nonetheless, she is a frequent voice of integrity on a council that has betrayed its constituents, the democratic process, and the interests of the broader community. I urge Celia to reconsider, hold her nose, and run. I urge this community to phone her and tell her they need her to do so, and they will help her to do so. And I urge this radio audience to call Celia Scott and tell her to run. The phone number to call at this time of night, you can just leave a message on the machine, is 429-3550, 429-3550, and say, Mayor Scott, run for re-election. We may not like everything you do, but if you don't run for re-election, we've got nothing left but Rotkin, Matthews, and Canfield running the town. My producer has brought me some older metros where we actually have the information around of a letter from Fred Geiger defending Phil Baer, and we may actually have the original article. Nope, we don't have the original article around. Oh, yes, we do. We have the original article around Phil Baer. So maybe what we'll do is call Phil, get him on the line, and see what his thoughts are on the latest brouhaha around this whole issue. Again, the issue fundamentally is, was it appropriate for council members Hernandez and Kennedy to apparently use city staff and forward to the district attorney complaints about Bears being in a meeting and supposedly organizing or supporting discrimination against Latinos? And the individual who made that complaint, who gave that complaint to Hernandez and Kennedy, refused to be named and apparently later withdrew it. Now, I don't know the facts of the matter. I wasn't at the end of the line when the supposed phone calls came through to Kennedy and Hernandez, and it's really an interesting question. Let's listen to a little music and see if we want to pursue this issue a little further. Stay with us.
If you can't be careful, try to be good. Well, we cared and we cared as much as we could. We always agreed, me and my man, we said someday we'll try the family plan. The first thing we tried was nothing at all. It was an amateur ride and everything's here fall. We charted my tides, followed my moon, but then someday came a little too soon. I got the 9 months of blues. Too much to gain, too much to lose. But he was kind of happy when he heard my news. I got the 9-month blues. There was him and me and the baby made three. But we made up our minds to stay that way. With little bitty things made of rubber and such. And cause we were friends, we decided to go Dutch. When we said I do, it was a solemn oath. So we did and we did and it pleased us both. We still can't figure out what went wrong. But that's the first line of the 9-month song. I got the 9 months blues. Too much to gain, too much to lose. I get out the dress and the sensible shoes. I got the 9 months blues. I said, this time around I'm gonna cast my stone. I'm gonna have a chance to call my life my own. About the SPC, the FDA, they said, keep that child, don't fling it away. The doctor said he had the right to refuse. The law says if you want to beat the noose, you gotta be rich or near to your grave. So away I went again on the 9-month rave. I got the 9-month blues. Too much to gain, too much to lose. And that time around I gotta make choose. I got the 9 months blues. That made me, my head burst open and I nearly went crazy. And my moon started rising every 14 days. It says I may be sick, but I'm safe and free. We started making honey like a couple of bees. But one May morning, I must have forgot. Dropped me right back into the 9-month slot. I got the 9-month blues. Too much to gain, too much to lose. I want my old man be happy when he hears my news. I got the 9-month blues. I got kids everywhere, 2, 3, 4, 5. I just can't swim without taking the dive. I went for advice, they says it to me. They said the next thing to try is the IUD. But the small print allows that the loopity-loop has a margin of error, then you're in the soup. But your kid'll be normal, so don't you fret. Even though you're leashed for the 9-month lead, I got the 9-month blues. Too much to gain, too much to lose. I better get my old man to disconnect his fuse. I got the 9-month blues. I love my man, I love my kids, but if I have any more, I'm gonna blow my lid. It's not just the 40 weeks on my mind, it's also the washing hanging on my line. It could be the worry on the old man's face, or thinking of the future of the female race. It all began with a loving and a laughter, then it's so much care. For such a long time after every 9 months of blues. Too much to gain, too much to lose. Now don't you think we ought to have the right to choose to sing the 20-year blues?
And that was the 9-month blues, Peggy Seeger's famous song. And we are here still on Free Radio Santa Cruz, and hopefully so are you. I guess that's where you are, if you can hear me. On the line with me is community activist Phil Baer. Hi, Phil.
Hello, Robert.
And you've been in the news a lot lately there, Phil.
Well, that's how it feels to me.
What I'm going to do is kind of reacquaint the audience with what this is all about, if I can find, of course, the appropriate clippings, which, of course, have disappeared at this key moment, as they usually do. Ah, here we go. At the bottom of the stack. Metro Santa Cruz on July 8th had a story. Actually, it was July 1st. That's one we don't have at the moment. But the current issue of the Metro has come out with a story around the incident of I guess, concern when Michael Hernandez and Scott Kennedy purportedly forwarded a complaint to the district attorney's office, saying in essence, or perhaps they told someone to take the complaint to the district attorney's office, that you had been a participant in a landlord meeting in which discrimination against Latino tenants was being discussed as some kind of good policy, something like that? Was that the...
Well, the allegation, totally unfounded, not related to anything whatsoever that actually occurred.
Mm-hmm. Well, what happened, and what do you make of all this?
Well, I think that it's really not an issue of me as an individual, and it's not an issue that has anything really to do with racism. That the underlying reality of what's going on is that I've been somewhat visible in the resistance to the beach area south of Laurel Comprehensive Plan, which is the baby of the three individuals who have accused me thus far, all members of the past or present members of the Redevelopment Agency, which is the lead agency behind the beach area south of Laurel Comprehensive Plan. And those folks are dreadfully afraid that they have an unpopular plan, and this is simply an unscrupulous way they are attempting to intimidate anyone who might take objection to that plan.
Well, as a devil's advocate, let me read aloud this letter from Don.
Feel free.
If you can suffer through this.
Mm-hmm.
This is a letter in the current issue of the Metro. It's subtitled McCarthyism of the 90s and reads as follows. Phil Baer, in his July 1st letter, accuses two city council members of playing the race card. Baer is clearly expert in this subject, having played an almost full deck of those cards in his career as a, quote, landlord activist in the beach flats for more than two decades. Whether or not the specific allegation of Baer organizing to discriminate against Latino tenants is verifiably correct is beside the point. What's relevant is that the allegation was credible because of Baer's history of comments about Latinos. I sat through several city council meetings in the late 80s and early 90s where Baer made comments I felt were remarkably insensitive to Latinos. It was clear that Baer saw the Latino residents of the beach flats as an other group that were to be feared, that they were his adversaries in the neighborhood. I knew many in attendance at those meetings felt that those comments were racist, and one council member, a person of color, explicitly stated she felt his remarks were racist. I can also recall many of Baer's comments and activities relating to opposing low income in beach flats over the years. Frequently, the focus of his comments were to the effect that he didn't want such a concentration of Latinos in one place. With this historical context, imagine you are one or two city council members who received phone calls from a beach flats landlord saying that Phil Baer and other beach flats landlords had met to discuss discrimination against Latinos in filing their rental units or filling their rental units. I don't think it's too much of a stretch to imagine that you and your colleague would contact the proper enforcement authority, since this kind of housing discrimination, if it occurred, would be both offensive to your sensibilities and a serious violation of the law. This is all that Hernandez and Kennedy did. It would be most troubling to me, and I hope to most community members, if they had done nothing. It's important to note that neither Hernandez nor Kennedy went public with allegations. They did not label Baer or the other beach flats landlords as racist. They quietly and responsibly asked the DA to look into a potentially illegal act. How then did this atrocious act, Baer's words, of reporting a troubling and credible allegation of racial discrimination come to light? It seems that Mr. Baer revealed it. Why he did this is anybody's guess. It could be that he was doing just what he accused the council members of doing. He is locked in a battle with the council members over beach area redevelopment. How better to discredit them than to make it look like the McCarthyism of the 90s? Baer wonders in his letter whether he doth protest too much about the allegations. Clearly, he doth. Don Lane, Santa Cruz. What do you say about that, Phil?
Oh, I take umbrage at the letter. I would hardly know where to begin.
Let me ask you, well, let's begin at the beginning. Are you an expert at playing the race card and having an almost full deck of those cards in your career as landlord activist in the beach flats?
No, not at all. I don't think Don understands the way the phrase playing the race card is ordinarily used. It's not related to racism. It's used to describe the tactic of using the accusation of racism as a way of silencing people for other motives. And whatever I might or might not have done was not of that nature whatsoever.
Now, Lane claims that in several city council meetings, and he was, of course, a council member from 88 to 92,
mm-hmm.
he observed or heard comments that were, quote, remarkably insensitive to Latinos, in which you saw Latino residents of the beach flats as an other group to be feared. What do you say to that?
Well, that's all very vague, you know. If I said something before the city council, as you know, it would have been into the microphone during oral communications. It would be part of the public record, and Mr. Lane could pull it out and offer explicit quotes and be prepared to provide the transcript of those meetings to prove that his allegations are somehow based on something that I actually said. There is absolutely no specific quote here. He will not pull out a tape recording or a transcript of a city council meeting at which I said something racist, because I never said anything racist, and if I did, he would have provided that transcript. The vagueness of the whole allegation, you know, to talk about insensitivity to Latinos and talk about me seeing them as the other group that were to be feared, this is obviously, at the very most, some sort of an interpretation. I would think that if there was something to it, he would put it as a quote, or at least attempt a paraphrase. There's nothing like that at all. The other many in attendance at those meetings, who? Name a name. The council member, the person of color who explicitly stated that she felt his remarks were racist.
I would assume he is speaking of Jane Yokoyama.
One would assume that, though he doesn't say that. What council member, what comments? You know, there's no substance. I find it very difficult to respond to such a non-specific attack. There's not one quote, there's not one statement that I am accused of having made a specific statement. There is not one specific act that I am accused of having committed. How do you respond to this just labeling based on not one piece of evidence?
Well, in the next paragraph, he states, I can also recall many of Bear's comments and activities relating to opposing low-income housing in the beach flats over the years. Did you, in fact, oppose that housing over the years?
There was a housing proposal that they had in mind for across the street from us. It was to be called Vista del Rio on the piece of land that is now the Beach Flats Community Garden. It was an enormously dense project, one of those community housing corporation proposals, but much more dense than Neri's Lagoon. 55 units to the acre, most of which were to be 3 and 4 bedroom units. If you have some sense of what that translates to in terms of the size of the buildings, this was like 3, maybe 4 stories tall, virtually covering the entire parcel, no setbacks, in neighborhood that is basically historically significant, what is called Cottage City, the old original Santa Cruz fishing village. It has its own distinctive historical characteristics and architectural characteristics, and this thing would have been this gigantic thing right smack in the middle of it. Yes, in fact, we did object to that, I thought, in an articulate way, citing these sorts of objections, never saying anything about race.
So So his next statement, that frequently the focus of his comments were to the effect that he didn't want such a concentration of Latinos in one place, that comment is inaccurate?
Unfounded, absolutely without substance. If there were such a comment, he would have quoted it.
So as you look back over your, shall we say, ideological history or your political history in the last decade or two, do you see any change in either how you perceive the situation and spoken about it in the Beach Flats and the political positions you've taken? In other words, is there any sense in which you would say that you once had a position 10 years ago that was somewhat different than the position you had now, which some people might interpret as more conservative or, quote, racist?
No, the situation has changed. The crux of our run-ins with people like Lane in the 80s and into the 90s had to do with the fact that for a period of time from approximately 1980 until approximately 1994 or 5, this neighborhood was virtually ruled by a violent, heroin-dealing street gang. And our issue, as anyone who attended city council meetings during that time period will tell you, was consistently and almost only the request, the plea to the council to somehow free this neighborhood from that drug gang, something which Mr. Lane and the majority on the council were, for whatever reasons, reluctant to do. So we lived through a period almost 15 years in length in which we could hardly count the overdoses and the young people that we saw sucked into this heroin business.
Was this predominantly a Latino gang?
Well, you know, when something like this letter comes out, I hesitate to even speak to that subject, mm-hmm. Any such comment being so subject to misuse.
Mm-hmm.
Of course, that was, in fact, the case, as the police records or anybody who read the Sentinel or anything else or happened to work up the nerve to come down here and observe it would have testified. The